This is a Suno India production, and you're listening to Cyber Democracy. This podcast is in association with Internet Freedom Foundation. Technology has always been political. People developing the technology or promoting it have always influenced it. India is no different to this paradigm. Our first Prime Minister Nehru has influenced it in ways we can't really imagine. The legacy of political decisions influencing technological innovations have always affected our personal lives in both good and bad ways. But with all these issues, we as a country have transformed ourselves with the help of technology. It plays an important role in our life. A new book, Midnight's Machine, by Arun Mohan Sukumar, traces about the history of politics and technology in independent India. In this episode, the author talks about the book and some of the important stories of technology and its politics in independent India. Welcome to Cyber Democracy, Arun. Your book, The Midnight Machines, was released recently, and it goes into a great detail about finding out the history of technology and the politics involved in developing certain technologies in the country. One of the early things that you talk about in your book is why the technology, the idea of technology, or the idea of sovereignty in technology comes from Madan Mohan Malviya, who actually sets up the BHU, Banaras Hindu University. And his beliefs were the ones which were core to setting up various technology institutions in the country. Can you start with that, explaining us why it was important that Madan Mohan Malviya thought that sovereignty in technology was important?
I think many of us are familiar with Madan Mohan Malviya as an important figure in the freedom movement, his role with the Congress as a moderate, quote-unquote, a moderate in the Indian National Congress, his work with the Hindu Mahasabha, and of course his founding of the Banaras Hindu University in 1980. Now, Malviya represents a group of technocrats who in India believed that India had to imitate and not innovate in the first initial stages of industrialization. Like Vishveshwaraya, for example, Madan Mohan Malviya looked to Germany, to Meiji Japan, for example, and Germany as well, to see what are the lessons India could learn from the process of industrialization in these economies. And they realized that a lot of it had to do with importing machines in the first stage of industrialization. Then, as he says, to imitate and to absorb those technologies directly in your economy. And then from there, your R&D base can be created once you've absorbed those machines into your own domestic economy. And so he was a true technocrat in that sense, and differed in his political and technocratic vision from Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, who did not believe that you should just absorb machines directly into your economy for fear of being slaves. Now, that's his view, and that Pandit Nehru's view, and that sort of stemmed a little bit from Mahatma Gandhi's own view of machines and his mistrust towards industrialization. I think Malviya's view is important, and that's why I sort of begin the book with him, because I feel that his technocratic vision has attained a new lease of life thanks to Narendra Modi. There are many political similarities between Malviya and Modi, especially Malviya's affinity in the later stages of his political career towards moving closer to the Hindu Mahasabha and so on and so forth. But most importantly, they believe in this, you know, in the program that Modi calls Make in India. But for all intents and purposes, Malviya is the ideological, the founding father of that ideology of Make in India, of import substitution, building things in India and then exporting them to the world. Whether they are made elsewhere, you know, it doesn't matter. He did not believe that Indians should just innovate and create these new technologies that are useful for the world, but that, you know, you should import machines, make them better, make them cheaper at home, and then export them to the world. Much like how Japan and Germany in the early 20th century and the late 19th century managed to achieve their respective successes, which is why the book begins with Malviya.
Well, that's a really interesting start on how you say that the rise of technology in India was also pushed by people and their own beliefs, and at some level, which is what is happening right now. But at the start of independent India, it was Nehru who was driving all of this. And it was Nehru's vision at some level, but at the same time, his own politics, which were involved because he had to balance out between modernizing India and also he had to keep the Gandhian followers happy on not industrializing heavily so that we don't want villages to not sustain or cities to grow. It was a complex task. And in doing that, Nehru helped set up a lot of technology institutions. There were a lot of people who drove all of these programs. But then over the first technology scam of independent India happens, which you describe very beautifully in your book. Can you talk about the solar cooker project?
Nehru had a very Aristotelian view towards technology, and that's the book's primary argument, that you cannot believe that technology comes from the heavens or from some sort of a force that is more intelligent or more superior to you. Nehru believed that Indians should not be in awe of technology, but should do their best to understand it. And by understanding technology, Nehru believed that you would be able to master it eventually, which is sort of very Aristotelian in its view. We could, of course, with the wisdom of hindsight, say this was immature. It was was a naive view of how India should absorb technology, given that the vast majority of Indians at the time of Indian independence were illiterate and clearly did not have the intellectual resources, or for that matter, the educational institutions that could sustain their understanding of technology. So, with this view, Nehru set about creating some of the celebrated national institutes of scientific and technological research, out of which the IITs are the most famous one. He also created the of course, all of this was created with the help of foreign collaborators, something that we should not ignore. These were not created out of thin air by Indians alone. We have to acknowledge the valued contribution of other countries in the setting up these institutions. He also set up, with the help of Shanti Swarup Bhatnagar and others, the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, CSIR. And one of the crucial wings of the CSIR was the National Physical Laboratory. One of the early instances of a quote-unquote scientific breakthrough of the NPL was the solar cooker affair, which is what I describe in my book. I'm not the only social scientist to describe it, nor is this for the first time that is someone describing it. Shiv Vishwanathan's excellent chronicle of the CSIR called Organizing for Science, which was published in 1985, describes it eloquently. Commentaries at that time also spoke about the solar cooker and its failure. D.D. Kusambi, for example, the social scientist and mathematician, was one of the strident critics of it. Essentially, the solar cooker was an effort by the NPL to create a solar cooker for cooking vegetables with the help of solar panels that would mitigate energy consumption in India, but also sort of be cost effective and affordable for the vast majority of Indians who could not really afford a lot of high technology appliances for household purposes. The problem was that the appliance was far ahead of its technology. Solar technology had not come of age in any serious way, even in the United States. This was the time when experimentation was being conducted on solar technology and how to sort of miniaturize it into appliances like solar cooker. And therefore, it was very difficult to produce this at scale. The NPL apparently had a viable prototype, which was allegedly given to the Prime Minister, and the Times of India famously carried a news report one day saying that Prime Minister Nehru had boiled cabbages and vegetables for dinner using the solar cooker one fine night. But, you know, this was never tested because the ordinary public never got to use this appliance. Even within the NPL, it was widely reported that the scientists in the laboratory were using the solar cooker to warm up coffee. The problem was also that the intended audience for this cooker, even if it did work, was the agrarian population of India, who would leave for their fields very early in the morning before the sun was strong. And therefore, the appliance itself had very little use for ordinary Indian households. And the world really hadn't discovered an effective way of trapping solar energy for any sustainable period of time. And therefore, this cooker failed. But the interesting aspect about the failure of the solar cooker was the amount of political and personal capital that Nehru and Shanti Swarup Bhatnagar, one of the most legendary scientists of the establishment, had put into this project. The book argues that Nehru had put in so much capital into this project because this was an example of genuine Indian innovation. Technology that was made for India, made for Indians by Indians. And therefore, it was natural that the Prime Minister would try and invest and promote this politically as much as possible. He even tried, in the spirit of solidarity and internationalism, tried to export this to Egypt and South Africa. You know, one commentator, Riley, notes that after one order was placed, I think it was South Africa, Rhodesia, did not ever again repeat the order for the solar cooker. Despite the fact that this technology was new and untested, somebody who clearly was aware of what was going on in the world and was advised by prominent intellectuals like Shanti Swarup Bhatnagar, decided to put his weight behind this cooker, because this is the golden age of Indian science, when people believed, the scientific establishment at least believed, that they were totally invulnerable because they were born into the atomic age, much like we were born in the backdrop of two atomic bombs dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And therefore, we thought these benefits of science and technology would also come to us through our institutes of excellence and so on. They never did, for various reasons. They were, you know, India was denied access to a lot of technologies, and we simply couldn't develop it fast enough. So the book lays blame on Nehru for failing to adequately appreciate the link between market and the laboratory. And the solar cooker is cited as the prime example of the Indian scientific establishment's failure to develop a strong link between the scientific laboratory and the Indian market.
So it's really important to understand that you mentioned the Nehru's relationship with the market and his own views on socialism and his own views of Gandhi and adapting it towards modernizing India, where he was also contradicting some of his own beliefs on which India was formed. The idea of private sector participation in state development or development of India was completely rejected by Nehru, which is why you see that it was the state and state institutions which were doing a lot of these projects. But in terms of technology, you did mention that how Nehru felt that if capitalists, or rather the market, had both the power of technology and the power of money, it could be a problem, which did cause its own effects on the country, delayed projects. But can you tell us more about this?
We are judging Nehru with the wisdom of hindsight. It is, of course, easy for us to criticize a particular view of Nehru, given the legacy of state-backed innovation in India and how successful or unsuccessful that has been. But it's also important to realize that Indian industry at that point of time, in 1947 and onwards, was, you know, all but a fledgling industry, let alone companies that could genuinely promote scientific research and innovation. Somebody had to be the custodian, for lack of a better word, of research in India. And Nehru believed that the state would be that custodian. He believed that the national laboratories, which were by no means an isolated phenomenon, national laboratories were created in the US. They were created in the USSR. Across ideologies, you had this phenomenon at that time of national laboratories coming into being, which were, you know, championing research to various degrees of collaboration with the private sector. The problem in India was that you didn't have, as I said, a private sector that could really measure up to the state in its matching or going toe-to-toe with the state's resources. And there was another reason. These technologies, like I said, were subject to various export controls after the Second World War. The United States and the USSR did not want technologies falling into, quote-unquote, the wrong hands. And they also were interested primarily in supporting technological innovation in their respective spheres of influence. They wanted technology for their own allies, and they were willing to dispense with them only for their own fellow travelers. India, being a non-aligned country, did not belong to either camp, and therefore it was difficult for India to extract these technologies, this know-how for creating new machines, without having been drawn to one camp or the other. So it stands to the credit of Nehru and his cadre of diplomatic and scientific advisors that despite this fractious geopolitics that characterized India's independence internationally, we were able to get access to many of these technologies without having to cede our independence or without having to toe any particular camp in the Cold War. It was easier for him to do that if he made the state, the, like I said, the primary custodian of innovation in India. For example, when the World Health Program, the World Health Organization, if I'm not mistaken, approached Nehru with a proposal to create antibiotic penicillin in India, Nehru did entertain negotiations with the American pharmaceutical company Merck. There were, you know, some extensive negotiations with Merck. At one point, the negotiations broke down because Nehru did not believe that it would be in the interest of an Indian company to collaborate with Merck for fear for various reasons. Now, we all know Nehru mistrusted capital. He did not believe that, you know, capitalism was a force for good in society. And he perhaps believed that these collaborations would be lopsided and eventually it would only be a matter of time before the American company or multinational company would just cannibalize its Indian partner and create products that were out of the reach of most ordinary Indians. That view of thinking is obviously flawed. It needed to be more nuanced. But the fact is that on many things, he has been proven right. India is today, you know, is known as the world's pharmaceutical laboratories. We are able to create generic medicines for the rest of the world, for life-saving drugs. We have to acknowledge the Nehruvian legacy in steering us to the right path. But it also completely obfuscated the fact that private corporations are more agile and are capable of responding to the needs of the market in a way that the state can never be. Fact is that he was, like you said, it was a balancing act. He was surrounded by people of various ideologies. On the one hand, there were technocrats like Baba, Sarabhai, Shanti Bhatnagar. These were people who belonged to the Indian state in their pursuits, but there were people who had no problems working with the private sector. And you know, they could have just as well run a private establishment instead of a national laboratory. On the other hand, Nehru was also surrounded by Gandhians like Joseph Kumarappa. Gandhians like him were carrying forward the Mahatma's legacy. And they wanted nothing to do with machines themselves, let alone the private sector. So it was a balancing act. And we can say again, with the wisdom of hindsight, that Nehru did not do good enough of a balancing act. And it is true that by the second five-year plan, he had pretty much abandoned this small is beautiful, you know, technology by India for Indians philosophy, and he had sort of pushed towards the River Valley projects, major projects of industrialization, because he too realized that in order to build up small technologies that could be cited as successful examples of Indian innovation, you needed the big machine, and the big machine would only come by importing it from countries that had been able successfully to manufacture it to economies of scale. And once you imported cheap technologies, then of course you could spin off these derivative or secondary industries from them.
I think it was the time when import restrictions were abandoned and it was hard procuring some of these technologies, and also the customs tax. We were almost in those license rush, right? Speaking of all of these restrictions, we still had some international cooperation, which is how we set up most of these institutions. But when it came to critical technology requirements for defense, we never could succeed in getting that. And we saw the lack of it was a problem with the 1962 China war, which is what led to the creation of the Electronics Corporation India Limited. While ECL's formation in itself is a story, how do you think this creation of state institution was continued under Indira Gandhi after post-Nehru? We didn't leave away the Nehruvian legacy. It continued during Indira Gandhi times as well. But how she saw technology, or how she tried to import technology because of her own friends, and how she was influenced by the hippies in the valley. Can you talk us more about all of this?
So 1962 is a turning point by which time we are made painfully aware as a country of our acute lack of capability in manufacturing primary electronic components like capacitors or diodes or transistors, which are, of course, all essential for building, whether military or civilian, electronic appliances out of them. As is famously known now, our ordnance factories were manufacturing espresso machines because we had excess capacity, but we really didn't have the know-how or the tools to manufacture actual military equipment. The 1962 war with China exposed the deficiencies of the Indian scientific establishment, and we were sort of quick to acknowledge the problem. Immediately after war, the Electronics Committee of 1963 was constituted under the chairmanship of Homi Bhabha. It had some of the leading visionaries of the scientific establishment, including A.S. Rao, and who went on to become the chairman of the ECIA. And it also had military men. And one of the book's arguments is that because it was cloistered in such a secretive environment in the backdrop of a humiliating loss in 1962, most of the deliberations of that committee became closed to the public. We know now that the committee mapped meticulously the exact capacity of India to manufacture electronic components that were required to attain self-sufficiency. But the fact is that the solution that the committee found out for resolving this problem of deficiency was again turning to the state. By that time, the Nehruvian legacy had become distorted, and Indira Gandhi, when she became the prime minister of this country later that decade, would totally distort it and would twist it out of recognition. So the license Raj, of course, import restrictions, as you said, Srinivas, always existed, but they acquired a new flavor and they acquired new severity in the late 60s and 70s all the way to early 80s. There were other circumstances beyond our control that also prevented us from developing technology. Even if we wanted to open up our economy and sort of absorb technology, we're still a poor country and we did not have the financial wherewithal to import technology at scale, at a serious scale required to modernize. And whatever money we had was spent in either purchasing food from abroad, we were living, quote unquote, a ship-to-mouth existence. We were buffeted by back-to-back famines in 1965 and 1966, and the Green Revolution would soon hit us. After the famines, and as a result of the famines, the introduction of high-yield variety of crops into Indian fields acquired a great deal of urgency. But the fact is that we did not have the resources to industrialize during this period. And the book's argument is that to mask its failure at acquiring technology and to develop it at home, Indira Gandhi and her advisors co-opted what was called the appropriate technology movement. Now, the appropriate technology movement essentially took off in a big way in mid-60s and saw its heyday in the 70s. It essentially said that small is beautiful. You had to apply technologies that were labor intensive and not resource intensive. And you could create technologies that were at scale that could attend to the needs of a neighborhood or a village or a panchayat, as opposed to attending to technologies that address the problem of a city or a state or a country for that matter. And one of the leading visionaries of the appropriate technology movement was the economist E.F. Schumacher. But even before Schumacher had written his famous book, Small is Beautiful, a 29-year-old PhD student by the name of Amartya Sen had already distinguished between landesque and laboresque technologies. Technologies that invest in land and deplete labor, and conversely, laboresque technologies which are more labor-intensive. And so Indira Gandhi and her establishment essentially hijacked this movement and said India should invest in, and if you go through the archival records, public records of this period from the late 60s up until the 80s, you will find there are a number of government seminars that were organized by the government promoting appropriate technology, trying to mechanize bullock carts, trying again to develop solar technology for consumer appliances, make biogas out of cow dung, all technologies that were clearly untested and unviable for that time. Even now, we're struggling to scale up some of those technologies, but were clearly not viable, but yet were sold to an unsuspecting public for reasons entirely different from the actual reason why the appropriate technology movement germinated, which is the fact that there was excess consumption of resources and there was a real concern that the world would soon run out of resources. In India, the problem was not resource depletion, but the fact that here was a political establishment that just could not develop technology at home, and its hands were tied when it came to importing them from abroad. Unfortunately, the appropriate technology movement in India had a willing intellectual class that was taken in by this movement and therefore became useful idiots. It's a harsh assessment that I make in the book. The great V.S. Naipaul once wrote that the process of mechanizing bullock carts is a fascinating intellectual adventure, but totally sterile and devoid of all utility for those concerned. Intellectual class were an unwitting ally for Indira Gandhi's political calculations. And we know that this was entirely political because by the 80s, Indira Gandhi herself had been singing a completely different tune. The problem was the appropriate technology movement was not just something confined to India. In fact, the roots are international. As you said, the appropriate technology movement and its sister movement, the counterculture movement, is what led to the birth of Silicon Valley. So just as Silicon Valley was sort of blossoming into its own, we had this movement in India that was entirely cynical and politically useful to the prime minister and her party, but really was not sincere to the process of modernization or the ethos of modernization in India.
While we went through a lot of these revolutions, we solved a lot of our problems. White revolution, green revolution, essentially solved a lot of our domestic problems with domestic technology, with some being imported from abroad. But most critical thing that you talk about, or which was like a breaking point or a tipping point for the Indian IT to become of the global age, is of the Y2K problem, or the Y2K bug. And you trace back how India positioned itself as a IT power, and rather rose as an IT power during this time. And you also share stories of how ISRO fixed the Y2K bug much before any of the other government institutions did. Can you tell what the Y2K bug was? I guess a lot of people don't know what it was and what's its relevance for India's technology history is. I mean, outside the technology industry.
My dad got me my first computer in 1999, a year before the Y2K problem, that had a Pentium 3 processor, which was fast for its time. On that note, you know, you mentioned, you began your query, Srinivas, by pointing to the Green Revolution and the White Revolution. Now, the people associated with the Green Revolution, they are today celebrated as national heroes. You know, M.S. Swaminathan is feted as the father of the Green Revolution in India. The chap behind the White Revolution, Varghese Kurien, you know, they're all celebrated figures. But the fact is that this technology that we used to realize the goals of the Green Revolution and the White Revolution, before they became revolutions, to be honest, to a large extent, they were developed abroad. And of course, we tweaked it a little bit. But the fact remains that we were able to successfully introduce high yield variety of crops or better dairy management through cooperatives by understanding the experiences of the world. Unfortunately, in our narratives of self-reliance and national pride, we often ignore the fact that foreign collaboration has always been a crucial element of our success. Varghese Kurien was sent by the government, I forget the year exactly, but he was sent by the government to New Zealand to study dairy management under the Colombo Plan, which was a Commonwealth initiative, which provided so many technologies to us. The first fleet of buses in Bombay for BEST came from Canada. The dairy management, the dairy plants at RA Milk Colony at that time were totally revolutionized by the technology that came to us from Australia and New Zealand. The modern bakery chain got new lease of life thanks to the bakery, the food processing technology that was given to us by UK or Australia. All of this happened due to the Colombo Plan. So it's no surprise that the making of India's IT superpowerdom through the Y2K also happened on account of foreign collaboration. The Y2K problem essentially involved a legacy issue in COBOL, the computer programming language. Ever since COBOL became popular in the 60s and from then on forth, most computers that use COBOL had the firmware in those computers were coded to reflect the last two digits of the year. The clock in those computers reflected the last two digits of the year. So 89 would be 89, 99 would be 99, and 2000 would be 00. When the clock struck midnight on 1st January 2000, the computers would either think that we had reached 1900 or the year 3000. Absolute mayhem was a potential consequence of the computers misreading the exact year in which it was operating. This, you know, was not something to do with personal computers as it related to industrial control systems and enterprise computers. For example, one major concern was whether computers that were installed in aviation systems, what would happen when the clock struck midnight on January 1, 2000? Would radar systems suddenly think that the year is 1900 and show that there are no planes in the sky? So all kinds of disastrous consequences were predicted and foreseen by some of them scaremongers, but a lot of people, a lot of well-meaning and intelligent people also realized that this was a problem that needed to be urgently resolved. The fix, the Y2K fix, was not rocket science. All that was needed was to go through the lines of COBOL behind the computer firmware and convert the old two-digit designation of the year to four digits. So 2000 would become 2000. COBOL fixes had to be applied in advance rather than waiting till the last moment, and stress tests had to be conducted. And Indian companies rose to the occasion by fixing the problem for American and European businesses. They made the fortunes of modern-day Indian IT companies. Infosys, I believe, was listed on NASDAQ in 1999, the year of Y2K. 20 to 30% of Satyam's revenue and came from fixing Y2K that year. So it was clearly a gold rush for Indian companies. But the book also points, as you sort of mentioned right now, that ISRO, one Indian agency, was quite quick to identify the problem and fix the bug. And the reasons could be, I mean, we can only guess why ISRO had good computer scientists and more importantly, a good administrative setup that allowed those computer scientists to fix the problem. One was ISRO by that time had become relatively insulated from the bread and butter politics of India. To a legacy of autonomous appointments, ISRO had sort of began employing its own scientist cadre and of course could decide their pay scales and whatnot. So that degree of autonomy, I suppose, allowed for a freer degree of thinking and more agility to respond to the problems of the world. It also could be the case that this conversation may have gone to one of the political masters and ministry or secretary could have realized that ISRO, being a strategic establishment, it needed urgent redressing of the problem. Therefore, ISRO was given more resources to tackle the problem. Whatever, it probably is a combination of both. But the fact remains, going back to the original point, that the Indian state had very little role to play. ISRO may have fixed the problem, but the Indian state as such had very little role to play in the whole Y2K affair. It was mostly Indian companies going out, fixing the problems and coming back, making their fortunes in the process. The Indian establishment had the wisdom of not standing in the way of these companies, which again sort of is on account of a legacy of technocrats like N. Seshagiri, the guy behind NIC, National Informatics Center, understanding that this was a sunrise sector of the Indian economy and therefore should not be licensed like a traditional sector of the industry. And there were other bureaucrats also who subscribed to that vision. On account of all these reasons, the Indian private sector sort of rose to the occasion. And it is quite intriguing, but not surprising, that first success of a mass technology movement, because in 1999, there were probably 40,000 computer scientists or coders in India. That number probably expanded to 5 times or 10 times more by 2005. And computer programming and cyber cafes became ubiquitous. So computing reached the masses, no thanks to the Indian state.
All of this has to do with a lot of Nehruvian legacy also, because you see that it was mostly IITians and especially from IIT Kanpur and Mr. Narayan Murthy at Infosys who also played a lot of role in this. But moving on, you trace the history of biometrics in your book on how the Indian state was always using fingerprints, part of the Indian Evidence Act of 1889 or so, on how we have always used forensic science. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, so the book does talk about the history of biometrics. I am by no means the first social scientist to talk about it. The authoritative history of fingerprinting in India has been written by historians like Simon Cole and Chandak Sen Gupta, who talk about, meticulously document how the process of fingerprinting came about and was adopted by the Indian state. And the origins are colonial. It was used in Bengal for the first time by a British officer who captured the fingerprints of his Indian interlocutor to scare him into ensuring that the contract is in fact fulfilled. So even the first instance of biometrics was to intimidate and coerce somebody into fulfilling his or her obligations. You know, in the 20th century, there are documented instances of protests in places like the Kolar gold mine. The company that is in charge of the mine or owns the mine decides to adopt fingerprints as a method of marking attendance, against which there is great protest, and the method is then subsequently rolled back by the company in the face of those protests. The use of biometrics has had a checkered history in India, and I don't think we can ever shake that colonial legacy, the way in which fingerprints have been used by the Indian state even after independence. At the time, India was one of the few countries to develop its own indigenous fingerprint recognition system. And we should ask how India was able to create this particular technology indigenously while we were unable to create others. The fact is that a lot of resources were put into the development of this. I should clarify, and I'm not sure whether the other foreign collaborators were involved, but it's my understanding that this was something that was truly designed by India for Indian law enforcement agencies. Then there were people who were trained in biometrics who are also involved in the planning of the economy, the most notable of them being the great PC Prasanta Mahalanobis, who was Nehru's right-hand man in terms of national planning. And Mahalanobis believed, you know, as he told somebody who had come to interview him, that the Indian economy could be built up like human anatomy. So biometrics was not only instrumental in, you know, creating this sort of instrument for law enforcement, but also seeded or spawned a technocratic vision for governance in India, which is something that's not often talked about. It is not until recently that we could really talk about the capturing of biometrics for programs like Aadhaar or, you know, other governance programs. So it's, you know, my job as a historian in this book was to at least provide some context. Now, whatever view we may have of Aadhaar, you know, whether as somebody who's involved in the technology policy space or whether who's a citizen of this country, I think it's important to understand the context in which biometrics developed in India. And that's what I'm trying to do, because I keep saying, as I move closer to the present, and the book is essentially a chronological telling of how technology developed or did not develop in India. I have my own views of Aadhaar, and as I move closer to the present, I probably lose the benefit of distance and the wisdom of hindsight. But it's important as citizens and policy analysts that we understand the history and see to it that these technologies are not misused by the establishment of the day, but also to shake off some of those old concerns by understanding that this is, you know, we are living in a different time. It is possible to regulate those technologies, the use of those technologies through legal means, through checks and balances introduced by the government and with the support of civil society and the private sector.
So you do talk about that age of Kor Mangla in your book, comparing it with the Gilded Age of the US. So I'd like you to elaborate on that. At the same time, there is a really interesting review of your book in The Wire by Shankar Sunil Nair, which gives you the credit for an amazing book, but at the same time critiques that you were unable to capture the people's movements around technology at some level. So in terms of the whole idea of a gilded age in the US, where you also had corruption and you had issues around it while the US grew at a very fast pace, can you just talk about both of these?
You know, the chapter on technocracy and the one on Aadhaar and Nandan Nilekani in particular, who, you know, the book presents as one of three technocrats whose work has had this visible, profound impact on the advancement of technology in this country, begins with the Gilded Age in the United States. And I think even in the United States, legal scholarship and historical scholarship now acknowledge that, of course, you have all the bad things that you associate with the Gilded Age popularly, which is corruption, cronyism, individual excess, and so on. But this period also saw the significant increase in the capacity of the state to govern its people. You had a great expansion in American bureaucracy at this time. Many of the agencies and regulatory institutions were designed by America to govern the market were created during the Gilded Age. And of course, you had the railroads being built and electricity lines being supplied and so on and so forth. A lot of it was being built by private corporations for the public good. So the chapter on technocracy and on Aadhaar and the role of institutions like iSpirit in creating what are called digital public goods is important in this historical context. India is now seeing a lot of these railroads being built for the digital economy, and the impact of the platforms are no longer limited to digital services supplied by Aadhaar or through the Unified Payments Interface, UPI or eKYC. They have offline consequences as well. They affect our lives in a profound way, and we don't need to have access to a computer or a mobile phone to be influenced by or be beneficiaries of these services. It also shows the Gilded Age in the United States offers us a lesson in that we should be careful about the role of private corporations in providing public goods, because that is how you had these conflicts of interest and corruption in the United States, and that is what we should be wary of in India. For example, now you have iSpirit, that I assume most listeners of the podcast would be familiar with iSpirit. It's a private NGO that supplies these or that creates these digital public goods, and it today has a ready audience within the government, because the government realizes that it needs these technological platforms to sustain innovation, but also provide those it believes are marginalized in society. And you can see many countries also approaching the problem of governance through these same technological tools, often with India's help. But as these tools are created, then institutions like iSpirit ought to be careful that you don't create a revolving door where one person creates a platform and then sort of moves into the private sector and works in the same space, or perhaps uses those same networks for undue personal gain. A lot of it is difficult to assess because we are still in very early stages of the development of these DPGs. But I think the Gilded Age offers us some lessons. First is that you need these tools that are developed by the private sector to increase state capacity. Second, while you develop these technology platforms, you should ensure that the platforms are open to everybody. And at the same time, they are not created by the private sector for the private sector, because the risk of capture is high. And lastly, it's also important to ensure that, you can't really ensure this, but it is going to be interesting to see whether the technocratic vision of governance reflects the political vision of governance. The entire book is about how politics twisted the introduction or rejection of technologies in India. The review in The Wire, which you alluded to, is correct. I have not been able to capture people's movements towards a particular vision of technology in India. Although, in, for example, the chapter on the emergency, I do quote surveys. They're not enough by any means, but they do reflect a certain zeitgeist where it does seem that in post-Green Revolution Punjab, you, for example, you had people who really wanted to embrace technology in a serious way and whose aspirations were completely misled by the government. But that said, the criticism is fair. And one of the reasons why I have not been able to capture people's movements in this book is that the attention has largely been focused on the state. Because in a democracy like India, the state is not just the arbiter of economic development, but also the aspirations of the people. Now, if the aspirations of the people do no longer are aligned with that of the state, then it poses a serious problem, which is also a lesson that the purveyors of digital public goods have to keep in mind. If you are using technology for rampant surveillance, unchecked abuse, then you know it is very difficult to convince the public, despite all the advancements that we have made in the last 3 decades about the virtues of technology. In fact, abuse of those technological platforms by the government for whatever short-term political uses, whatever to further a political, narrow, parochial political agenda, can have the unintended consequence of people once again, of Indian citizens becoming once again suspicious of technology. You know, and one final note on people's movements in India. The last 3 decades do provide a fertile ground for assessing some sort of a popular view towards technology. But before that, it's very difficult to ascertain whether people really thought of technology, civilian technology or military technology, one way or the other. Of course, you had environmental movements in India, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. You had anti-computer protests in the 70s, which led to the exit of the IBM. I would really not call them as popular movements, because how can you say that these represent an accurate interaction between the citizen and the machine in India when the vast majority of Indians did not have access to technology? It's only after 1991 that you really embrace technology as a country. That technology may, you know, maybe Casio watches or Sony Walkman or whatever consumer appliances flooded India after that. From the late 2000s, it has been replaced by Chinese mobile phones. But the embracing of Indian technology, of technology by Indian citizens, has happened in a sustained and serious way only after the 90s. And perhaps, you know, another historian will document those people, the responses by people. For example, social scientist Arvind Rajagopal, if I'm not mistaken, an excellent book that documents the role of the color television, especially the epic Ramayana, in fostering Hindutva, in seeding Hindutva in India. So technology has affected us in profound ways. The frame of reference that we have is quite narrow, 30, 40 years or so. And hopefully somebody will do the impressive job of documenting those popular sentiments.
And TV, which kind of came out of nuclear science research with the Indian state pushed. Anyway, that was Arun Sukumar for you on his book, The Midnight Machines. Thank you, Arun, for joining us.
Thank you, Srinivas, for having me.
Thank you for listening to the episode of Cyber Democracy. You can listen to this podcast on sonoindia.in or any other podcast app of your choice. As independent producers, we rely on you, our listeners, to support us. So please visit the support page on our website, sonoindia.in, and contribute generously.